loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, House Speaker Paul Ryan late last night quashed a rank-and-file effort to force a vote sponsored by a progressive Democrat that would abolish immigration and customs enforcement. Ryan concluded that while the bill had no chance of passing, Republicans could be embarrassed if Democrats opposed it in large numbers. Next, Maria Butina, a Russian woman who tried to arrange a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin during the 2016 presidential campaign, was arrested by the FBI on Sunday. The Justice Department says that Butina is a Russian intelligence officer or was acting for one who was tasked with infiltrating important U.S. institutions. Then Israel further tightened its blockade on Gaza yesterday, preventing gas and fuel deliveries through its only commercial crossing. When Israel announced the closing on July 9th, it promised to allow food, water, medicine, and fuel. That changed yesterday. And then the Iranian government said today that it is preparing to increase the level of uranium enrichment if negotiations with Europe on sanctions fall through. Meanwhile, Iran has filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice to, quote, hold the U.S. accountable for its unlawful reimposition of unilateral sanctions, unquote, according to the country's foreign minister. And finally, Elon Musk jumped into a scandal of his own making last week when he called a British cave diver who was instrumental in the rescue of a dozen Thai Boy Scouts from a flooded cave a pedophile. When called to task over the comment, he doubled down and repeated it. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE. House Speaker Paul Ryan late last night quashed a rank-and-file effort to force a vote sponsored by a progressive Democrat that would abolish the Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE. Ryan concluded that while the bill had no chance of actually passing, Republicans could be embarrassed if Democrats opposed it in large numbers. The bill was very unpopular with voters, or at least that's the media reports. We're joined from Los Angeles by Juan Jose Gutierrez, the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition. Juan Jose, welcome back to Loud and Clear.
Thank you for inviting me, Brian. Glad to be with you guys again.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting story because here you had mass demonstrations after the separation of children from their families, Trump's avowed policy, 700 demonstrations a week ago, 10 days ago. The Democrats and some of the Democratic Party front groups like Move On, who were at the demonstrations, listened to the audiences, the chants, abolish ICE, abolish ICE. ICE is the equivalent of a white supremacist organization. And then the Democrats started echoing that. And it sounded like maybe they'd introduce a measure in Congress to abolish ICE. They did so. And then Paul Ryan, the Republican, the hard right Republican counterpart, he's not as hard right as, you know, the so-called Freedom Caucus, but, you know, in American politics, very right. He said, okay, let's have a vote. And then the Democrats didn't want to have a vote because they didn't actually want to go on record opposing ICE, even though they said they did. And now we have this last iteration where the Republican conservatives, the most far right, said, yeah, let's have the vote. And then Ryan, because they wanted to embarrass the Democrats, they thought it was a good electoral ploy. And then Ryan pulled it. Anyway, that's part of the story. We want to get into the substance of what ICE is really doing. But let's just talk first about the politics of all of that.
Well, Brian, I think that what the Republicans did, in other words, pull a political ploy to embarrass the Democrats, equals another ploy by the Democrats to try to appear to the base, not just people that are supportive of immigrant rights, but all Democrats in the nation in their effort to win back at least one of the two houses of Congress, right? And so they did that 5 days ago by announcing that they were introducing a bill to, as you said, abolish ICE. But now we find out that it was all a ploy. So just like in math, in algebra, right? In this case, two ploys did not equal any benefit to immigrants or to anybody else for that matter. We have two parties in Congress, the Democrats and the Republicans, that are all about pulling political ploys that ultimately, as Shakespeare would say in Hamlet, signify nothing, because nothing changes. And that's really what we have right here.
Yeah. You know, and let's go to the substance of what's going on, too. Here's another part of the story. And again, what the Democrats are saying or doing is so important because it's the opposite of what maybe many of their supporters might think about. And that is that they were making the argument. At the same time, they were making the argument for ICE. They were also supporting sanctuary. Now, we're in Washington, D.C. This is a sanctuary city. And the Democratic Party controls the city. The mayor, Muriel Bowser, is a Democrat. Most of the people on the council, the D.C. council, are Democrats. Just in this last week, ICE was raiding people in their homes and picking people up on the street and detaining them. And last night I was at a demonstration where this happened close in the same neighborhood. And like more than 1,000 people were there. And people were chanting, "Where's Bowser? Where's Bowser?" Meaning, where's the Democratic mayor? Because even though this is a sanctuary city, it looks like the Democratic Party minimally doesn't want to stand up and defend the idea of sanctuary, and maybe is even colluding with, through the Metropolitan Police Department, colluding with ICE. Anyway, it's quite amazing.
Well, it's amazing because not just of the fact that the Democratic Party shows no spine time after after time when it comes to standing by working people, whether immigrants or not. They always find practical reasons not to stand with working men and women in this country to represent their best interests. So you gave the example of the sanctuary city, in this case, Washington, D.C., a majority Democratic city where we heard recently that raids are taking place and the Democratic control government of that city, including the mayor that you mentioned, majority city council, are doing little, if anything, to stand up to this onslaught of immigration arrest and possible deportations. And so what, you know, from my point of view, what's totally unforgivable is that the Democratic Party is aiming to regain the majority in Congress. And part of this, of their strategy has been to come up with a rhetoric of supporting immigrants, like with this measure to abolish ICE. But they won't defend their own bills. And the reason why they won't do it is because they think that in their political calculus, they will lose voters. So they get back to being practical, and in the end, they end up shooting themselves in the foot because their credibility goes lower with the larger electorate, who becomes very disappointed, when it comes out that we cannot count on the Democratic Party to stand by us. And that's really embarrassing that you say one thing and then you do another.
Indeed.
Compare that to the Republicans that when they have power, they ram things down everybody's throat, whether it has any realistic chance of becoming law or not. They do politics around their political moves, their political proposals, their legislative bills. The Democrats, not so much, very little. In their latest immigration ploy, it lasted but a mere 5 days.
Yeah,
and it's no more.
Truly something. Juan Jose Gutierrez is our guest. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Juan Jose is the executive director of Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition in L.A. This man who was arrested, the one I was talking about, one of the two in D.C., he had actually been the victim of an assault. He went to the police, the Metropolitan Police Department in this D.C., a sanctuary city, to report the assault. Instead, ICE agents came to his home they left because he wasn't there. He thought it was the police coming to follow up on his allegation. He flagged down MPD, Metropolitan Police Department guys in a squad car, and told them, "Hey, did you guys come to my house because I filed this complaint?" They didn't know what he was talking about, but then two ICE agents did come to his house. He's a father, 23 years old. He's gone. He's in jail. I mean, it's like from a point of view of public safety, if you're an immigrant, you can't even report criminal activity to the police, even in a sanctuary city, because you're going to get busted. You're going to be separated from your family.
And that's why progressives are calling for the abolition of the Immigration and Customs Enforcement. The reason for it existing was to provide greater safety, or at least that's how it was explained to the American public. That ICE was one more governmental law enforcement agency, to better serve the safety concerns of the American people. And what you have now is rampant violation of the human rights of many people, in this case, immigrants. You cited the example of what happened to this person reporting a crime who cannot feel safe anymore in doing so because they might end up, as many people have claimed, including myself, that people don't want to report crime because they're afraid that they'll get in trouble and they end up being arrested by ICE agents and deported.
That's the voice of Juan Jose Gutierrez. Juan Jose is the executive director of the Full Rights for Immigrants Coalition in Los Angeles, California. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Maria Butina, a Russian woman who tried to arrange a meeting between Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin during the 2016 presidential campaign, was arrested by the FBI on Sunday and charged yesterday with three counts of failing to register as an agent of a foreign government. The Justice Department says that Butina is a Russian intelligence officer or was acting for one and was tasked with infiltrating important U.S. institutions. She was apparently successful at ingratiating herself with the National Rifle Association, which, to the best of my knowledge, has no access to classified information. We're joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. He's a journalist and the author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Daniel, when I first read this news, I thought, oh, okay, well, this is a legitimate espionage case, you know, something that I have a personal interest in. So I jumped into the news and, where's the beef? You know,
It's not espionage.
It's not espionage, and that's the word they were throwing around yesterday. Well, today, now that the indictment has been released and the affidavit supporting the indictment, there's no evidence, not even any accusation of espionage. They're accusing her of three counts of failure to fill out a form, and that's about it. Yeah? Or am I missing something here?
No, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, she was a graduate student getting a master's degree at American University, and apparently on the side was doing some work trying to improve U.S.-Russian relations. Doesn't seem to be like very high-powered stuff. She had the crazy idea of somehow infiltrating or working with the National Rifle Association to persuade conservatives that better relations with Russia were to their advantage. She never seems to have gotten very far. She wanted to arrange an invitation for Putin to attend a national prayer breakfast, which strikes me as just ludicrous. It's a little nothing burger. I mean, you know, what's there? It's just everyone's going crazy in Washington, and the Foreign Agents Registration Act strikes me as something that's kind of a dead letter in Washington. It's rarely prosecuted. I really can't believe that there aren't countless British or Israeli, Chinese, French, et cetera, people running around in Washington, you know, arranging dinners and parties and trying to put their government's point of view across. And whether they actually fill out the form with the Department of Justice, I can't believe that many of them really even bother taking that small step.
Yeah, and that's actually what she's accused of not registering as a foreign agent. We have all sorts of foreign agents, as Daniel was saying. John Podesta's former lobbying firm, the Podesta Group, mm-hmm. now run by his brother. It's a foreign agent of Saudi Arabia, for
exactly.
instance. It's a commonplace. The other thing is, for our listeners, guess what? Every country has an opinion about what's going to happen next with the United States when there's going to be a new president, a new secretary of state. They care about that because they care about the relations between the United States, the biggest, most powerful economic and military force on the planet, with their country. And in the case of Russia, Russians want to improve relations with the United States because those relations have gone south. That's what she was trying to do. Now, here's the indictment. And, you know, one of our guests yesterday said she's actually guilty of politicking while Russian.
Yes.
Which I think is an apt explanation, because what other people do, which is considered normal or run of the mill, because if you're a Russian person, a person of Russian nationality, it's now suspect. Here's what she's it's a 3-page long indictment.
Mm-hmm.
It's the United States of America versus Maria Butina. That's not from the Mueller probe. Maria Butina was cooperating with Mueller
for many months.
She was meeting with Mueller
on her own volition. She volunteered to cooperate with Mueller.
She was giving them documents, and Mueller at the end of the day said, "I don't have any more interest in her." So guess what? The Justice Department goes ahead and indicts her after Mueller doesn't care about her anymore. Here's what she's actually accused of doing. I'm looking now at something called the Overt Acts. There's three of them. This is what she did. On or about March 14th, Butina emailed a person in an effort to develop and maintain a relationship in furtherance of the conspiracy meaning to improve relations with Russia. Two, in or around August 16th, Butina entered the United States on an F-1 student visa to go to UDC, University of District of Columbia, but she actually continued in the conspiracy of trying to improve relations.
Yes. And you know what she did? She actually hosted a dinner for American students and Russian students to talk about international affairs.
I want to get under my desk right now and prepare for the next nuclear war. And the third point of the indictment is, on or about September 26, 2016, Butina, again, emailed a U.S. person to organize an event. Again, maybe that's along the lines of the dinner, the conspiracy to have a dinner. That's it.
That's it. Literally.
That's it. This woman has been put in jail and is facing time in prison. And OK, what about this? Why was this indictment and this arrest happened yesterday when Donald Trump and Putin were meeting at Helsinki?
Well, according to thehill.com. It was meant as a big middle finger from the Mueller people to Donald Trump. That was it. That was the message.
So even though Mueller's not the indicting party, it's the
right.
DOJ.
Right.
Go ahead, Daniel.
Well, it's just like, you know, I mean, first of all, Americans have always prided themselves on the openness of their society. And this is a country where, you know, our strangers are welcome and everyone's entitled to a point of view, and the more the merrier. Let's have dinner together to discuss the future of U.S.-Russian relations. But now suddenly these very, you know, mundane, run-of-the-mill activities are now suspect because of this amazingly hysterical atmosphere that is now being drummed up. I mean, you have Susan Rice in a New York Times op-ed said, Donald Trump should not be allowed to sit down one-on-one with Putin. Who should not allow him? You have a congressman, Steve Cohen of Tennessee, a Democrat, said, our commander-in-chief is a traitor. Where is the military? Now, what is going on here? This is completely out of control. The hysteria is boundless, and now some poor 29-year-old young woman is winding up in jail because she arranged a dinner between Russian and American students.
She again, going back to the indictment, on or about March 14th, she sent an email, and on or about September 26th, she sent another email. That's it. That's the overt acts that constitute the conspiracy. But this hysteria has gotten so far gone that part of the, like the Washington Post is reporting, and now all the media is picking up, that Butina attended the National Rifle Association convention in Nashville. She felt the Republicans were more pro improvement of relations with Russia than the Democrats. So she joins the NRA. And she met Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, who's awful, by the way. He's a union
one of busting, the worst. Yes.
Union busting. Blah. I mean, we organized, me and my friends organized protests against Scott Walker. But what was his crime here? Was it busting unions?
No.
Depriving people of social benefits? He said in Russian to this woman, Marina Butina, hello. He said it in Russian.
That's actually been covered by all the major papers today. He said hello in Russian.
Scott Walker is a dupe because he spoke the word, he said hello in Russian to Marina Butina. That's actually part of the story.
Well, I think that speaking Russian itself is a very dangerous act. I think it's a sign of intent to engage in conspiracy to undermine America. The very language should be outlawed.
Yeah, anywhere else it would be considered, it's a racist, I don't know if racism is the correct word, but if you say people who are Russian or Russian descent, I mean, that was the demands of like the Senate Intelligence Committee on Jill Stein's campaign, that they demanded correspondence with all persons who are Russians. Jill Stein said, well, that's not a constitutional request, but that's where we are in America. You're getting arrested for politicking while Russian because of this witch hunt and hysteria. I don't know. I'm starting to have a loss of words for what's going on. This woman, she's 29 years old. She wanted to have better relations between her country, Russia, and the United States. She sent, according to the indictment, two emails on or about March 14th and September something. And now she's in jail.
Well, yeah, so this is ludicrous in one sense, but in another way, it's really very serious. I mean, she's in jail. She's languishing behind bars. She's a political prisoner, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, she is.
Number one. And number two, I mean, this atmosphere is dangerous. Whenever Americans talk this way, violence always follows. On one hand, a war with Russia seems, you know, impossible. But on the other hand, the rhetoric is so out of control that they are talking themselves into some kind of confrontation. This is getting to be really dangerous, really out of hand, and I think it should stop.
Yeah, Maria Butina's lawyer, who is an former assistant attorney general, I believe, issued this statement.
Robert Driscoll,
Marina Butina is not an agent of the Russian Federation. She is a Russian national in the United States on a student visa who recently graduated from American University in Washington, D.C. with a master's degree in international relations and a 4.0 grade point average. She has received her work permit and is seeking to use her degree to pursue a career in business. Ms. Butina has been cooperating with various government entities for months regarding public allegations related to her contacts with various American and Russian individuals. Months ago, she voluntarily and privately testified before the bipartisan United States Senate Select Committee on Intelligence for 8 hours, and she produced thousands of documents. She would have provided testimony and documents to federal law enforcement if requested to do so. She has offered through counsel to interview with the special counsel's office, that's Mueller, which has not expressed interest in her. Notwithstanding her cooperative approach, over a dozen FBI agents executed a search warrant on her Washington, D.C. apartment in April. Since that time, this is her lawyer. I'm going to end with this. Since that time, she has offered repeatedly to answer any question that the Department of Justice had. Rather than avail itself of that opportunity, the government chose to arrest Ms. Butina on Sunday without prior notice to her counsel, which had been consulting with them during these months.
That's right.
This is a political prosecution.
Thus
she is a political prisoner.
It was a bait and switch with this woman's freedom. That's what it comes down to. They used her, and when they were done with her, they threw her away.
And now she's thrown away in jail.
That should
be released.
Well, we're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from New York by Daniel Lazar. Daniel's a journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Israel further tightened its blockade on Gaza yesterday, preventing gas and fuel deliveries through its only commercial crossing. When Israel announced the closing on July 9th, it promised to allow food, water, medicine, and fuel. That changed yesterday. We're joined from Washington by Miko Peled. He's the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko also has a new book called Injustice, The Story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. And we're also joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She's a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. Welcome back to both of you.
Thanks so much for having us on.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Ariel, let's start with you. You were in Israel recently for about an hour before you were unceremoniously thrown out of the country. Tell us about the Israeli thinking on this issue. They made this promise, this commitment last week that they would allow humanitarian supplies through the crossing, and then they abruptly reversed themselves. What's behind that?
Well, this is no surprise, right? For over 10 years, Israel has been strangling the population in Gaza. Less than 4 hours a day of electricity. Sewage plants can't run. There isn't water. You know, the United Nations has said Gaza is becoming unlivable, but it's actually been unlivable for a long time. And Israel committing some new egregious act to strangle the enclave even further is just no surprise at all. I'm sure we're going to get to talking about the bombings that are taking place right now, Israel saying that they need to respond to flaming kites, tiny flaming kites, by dropping giant, likely American-made bombs on teenage children.
Well, let's go right to that, Miko. Let's talk about that issue. Again, it's just the whole disparity. Americans who know almost nothing, and why should they? Because they're getting their news from the corporate-owned media. We all enjoyed the World Cup. Israel took the occasion of the World Cup to actually, while people were watching the World Cup, to blow up a people who were in a cafe in Gaza, 9 people killed. Anyway, let's talk about what Ariel just mentioned.
Well, you know, it's almost as though Israel is trying to make the case to support the BDS for the BDS people. In less than 2 weeks, Israel has been bombing Gaza, destroyed the village of Khan al-Ahmar in the West Bank, and is now in the process of finalizing a bill that will become a what Israel calls a basic law, which is like a part of the Constitution, that defines Israel as the nation state of the Jewish people and is basically the codifying of all the racist laws and all the racist practices that Israel has been engaged in for 7 decades against the Palestinian citizens of Israel. So, I mean, what can you say? I mean, this is the ethnic cleansing, the genocide, and the apartheid regime all working together as though to say it's time to boycott, it's time to impose sanctions, it's time to isolate Israel. And it's only a matter of time now, I think, as the rest of the world is going to realize that this is the case.
I'm also curious, too, as to what the Egyptian reaction is to this. It was the Egyptian government that negotiated this, what was an apparent settlement to allow the humanitarian goods to cross. The negotiations were conducted in Cairo, and then the Israelis flipped. So what are the Egyptians saying about this? And is there any attempt to get people back to the table, at least to come up with some sort of a temporary solution? Ariel, do you know anything about that?
Well, you know, Kushner is in charge of this supposed peace plan, a peace plan that no doubt will not include ending the siege on Gaza, the right of return for refugees, will continue to deny access to Jerusalem, and so much more. And in exchange, Kushner has basically said that Palestinian rights and land are for sale. And why is this any surprise when you look at our administration?
Yeah, that's
and
true.
Our administration, and then there's this, well, I was going to say deafening silence from the Democrats, but it's not really a deafening silence. It's
No, they've jumped in on the side of the Israelis.
As they always do.
Yes.
And as Trump has made each one of these seemingly, you know, additionally egregious acts, like moving the embassy to Jerusalem, you have Schumer and the leader of the Democrats, you have them basically cheering that on. I mean, the resistance ends, well, it ends on a few places, the military budget, support for Israel. And now, Miko, you have liberal Democrats, including people who, some of whom say that they're socialists. They seem to be having wobbly knees when it comes to even condemning occupation or using the language of massacres, which are obviously true. What accounts for that?
You know, the Israeli lobby is very good at identifying potential threats, and they identify them quickly and they act very quickly. So as soon as somebody looks like they are on a path to becoming a serious politician or a serious contender for any kind of any elected office, they begin their campaign, and they've got carrots and they've got sticks, and they use them both, and they take people on junkets, and they give them all the support that they need, or they threaten them, and politicians know that if they don't listen to AIPAC and to all the other, you know, Israeli types of groups that are out there, that they will have no, that their political career will be over. So they do it much better than, I have to say, than the people on our side. And they're very effective, and they have deep pockets. And so they get to them very, very quickly. And as soon as the politicians realize that their career is on the line, they suddenly see the light, and they see that the Israelis are just, you know, poor little victims, and the Palestinians are terrorists and monsters and so on. And then the narrative continues. I think this is a lesson. There's a lesson here for people who do care for justice and do care for Palestine to act more swiftly and more effectively in getting to politicians and changing discourse, because it's very concerning and problematic. This is one of the reasons why the other side continues to win.
I have to say that that's really right. Look at the case of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who just recently defeated an incumbent Democrat in a congressional district in Queens in the Bronx. She's going to win that race, and she's going to become the youngest member of Congress in this session. Well, within 24 hours of her primary win, she made a statement saying that she is forever committed to the security and safety of the state of Israel. And people were taken aback by that, because there really aren't very many Jewish voters in her district. It's a very heavily Hispanic district. But again, virtually as soon as she won the race, she felt compelled to make that statement. And I think that Miko is correct. This is AIPAC. It's the lobbying firms here in Washington on K Street that make sure that any and every up and coming new politician is on the record as supporting Israel.
I would like to say on a positive note, I think we are beginning to see cracks in this. We've seen Representative Jamie Raskin, who does have a large Jewish constituency and
yes,
Jewish himself, start to speak out a bit. He's come out on a few things. We've seen Sanders really take leadership on this, you know, including that incredible video he put out recently about what the situation in Gaza. And so I would say that we're starting to see AIPAC lose a touch of its power, right? We have legislation to end the military detention of Palestinian children. We'd like to see a lot more in legislation that actually has, you know, teeth to it. But I think this is the beginning. And I hope to see her, when she gets in, really form these relationships with, say, Representative Mark Pocan's office and Betty McCollum, who introduced that legislation, Jayapal, who's speaking out, and see that there is a coming safety in denouncing Israel and standing up for Palestinian rights.
Miko, your take on all that?
Yeah, I mean, Ariel knows this issue well, because she does a lot of that type of work to get these people to gradually move over to the right side of the issue. I mean, the correct side of the issue and the justice side of the issue, and hopefully there is a trend going in that direction. But I think what she did was to be expected, and the Democratic Party, I think, is terrified. They're terrified of losing any of their constituents. And it's not about having Jewish constituents in a particular district. It's about winning an election. And if a politician does not, you know, toe the line, then they're in serious danger of losing the race or being outed as anti-Semitic and so forth. So I think this is a legitimate concern, but Ariel's absolutely right. I mean, there is a beginning of a change. And again, I would go back to our side and say, well, we need to do more. I mean, we don't have the money and we don't have the resources that the other side does, and we are seeing some progress. We need to double down and do more.
Indeed.
Absolutely.
Go ahead, Ariel. You have 30 seconds left, and that's all we have. Go ahead.
I was going to say the same thing as Miko. This is up to us as people to show that AIPAC will no longer be able to push people out of Congress for speaking up for Palestinian rights. And this is our job. It's laid out for us. And let's show up for Palestinians.
All right, John, we're out of time.
We are. We're out of time, so we'll leave it there. We were joined from Washington by Miko Peled. Miko is the author of The General's Son, A Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and also Injustice, the story of the Holy Land Foundation 5. And we were joined from Washington by Ariel Gold. She is a peace activist and the national co-director of Code Pink. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The Iranian government announced today that it is preparing to increase the level of uranium enrichment if negotiations with Europe on sanctions fall through. Meanwhile, Iran has filed a complaint with the International Court of Justice to, quote, hold the U.S. accountable for its unlawful reimposition of unilateral sanctions, unquote, according to Iran's foreign minister. We're joined from Urbana, Illinois, by Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law, and he's author of the book Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East Before and After September 11th. Professor Boyle, welcome back.
Well, thank you very much for having me on. My best to your listening audience.
Well, thank you so much. I want to start with the second part of this issue, and that is the Iranian case before the International Court of Justice. There's been so much made over the years of the United States not respecting decisions made in the ICJ. What do the Iranians hope to accomplish here?
Well, first, we have to understand it all depends on your perspective, the effectivity of the International Court of Justice. In this case, from what I have read here, Iran has filed a lawsuit and is seeking what is called an indication of provisional measures of protection against the United States, basically a temporary restraining order to stop what is clearly the economic warfare now that the Trump administration has decided to inflict on Iran as of last May. And that's very clear. Secretary of Treasury Mnuchin, everyone else has made it clear they're now engaging in worldwide economic warfare against Iran. So the purpose of the temporary restraining order, there'll be an emergency hearing of the court probably within 2 weeks. I would hope Iran would win that temporary restraining order. Then is to use that restraining order around the world to counteract the U.S. economic warfare against Iran. Obviously, that temporary restraining order, I doubt very seriously that the Trump administration could give diddly squat about it. But certainly, I think the Europeans might. If you look at today's Wall Street Journal, you'll see that Iran right now is in negotiations with the European governments, trying to work out a financing mechanism through their central banks. As you know, the United States has now threatened commercial banks that do business with Iran for sanctions. Clearly, those threats are illegal. They're extraterritorial. But I would think that if Iran could win this temporary restraining order, that would bolster its position, certainly with Europe and a good deal of the rest of the world, to take their side on these extraterritorial sanctions by the United States and try to work out something with Iran so they can continue to finance imports and exports. Second, if Iran were to win that temporary restraining order, I think we here in the United States could use that in the peace movement to try to forestall further measures by the Trump administration against Iran. This would be very similar to the temporary restraining order that Nicaragua won against the Reagan administration in 1984. And we in the peace movement at that time made very effective and successful use of that temporary restraining order in 1984 to try to stop the Reagan war of aggression against Nicaragua. And then since Reagan walked out of the world court, Nicaragua won a final judgment in 1986. And I was not involved in that litigation, but I was involved in almost every anti-Contra protest case here in the United States at that time, and also advising large numbers of peace groups, anti-war groups, including being counsel for the Pledge of Resistance and counsel for the Sanctuary Movement, on how we could use that 1984 temporary restraining order and the final judgment from the World Court to stop the Reagan wars of Nicaragua. So if Iran were to win this, hopefully, you know, we in the peace movement here could use it as grounds, legal grounds, to try to head off what appears to be, an escalating situation by the Trump administration. They've made it very clear that this economic warfare is part of a policy of regime change. I personally, don't think that's going to work. It's just going to be the innocent people over there in Iran who will suffer and have always suffered whenever we've engaged in economic warfare against another country, going back to Cuba, Libya, Iraq, you name it. It's only the innocent people who suffer. But if after a period of time that policy doesn't work by the Trump administration, then I'm afraid they're going to move towards threat and use of military force and aggression. And there, this lawsuit is very important for that as well, because if and when the Trump administration escalates to the threat and use of military force, say in the Persian Gulf, Iran can come in once again before the world court and get a temporary restraining order against any type of military threats or conduct by the United States against Iran. So I think this, is a very positive development, and perhaps it will have a role, at least to convince the Europeans to set up this financing system through their central banks. The Iranians have indicated that as long as they can get the benefits of the JCPOA, they'll stick with it. And I did want to state quite clearly here, I have read the entire JCPOA and the Security Council resolution there with the snapback sanctions. And there is absolutely no legitimate grounds or reasons for the Trump administration to have repudiated. And indeed, at the time of the JCPOA's conclusion, there were dueling press conferences by Secretary of State Kerry and Iranian Foreign Minister Zarif, which I listened to quite carefully. And obviously, one of them was not telling the truth. And I couldn't tell which one it was until I actually got the documents. And as I'm sure you know, I opposed Obama. He was behind me at Harvard Law School and abandoned and betrayed everything I was taught at Harvard Law School about the rule of law. But putting that aside, based on the documents I read, the JCPOA and the snapback resolution, everything Secretary of State Kerry said about the JCPOA in that press conference was correct. Everything he said. Now, he went, to Boston College Law School, so he's a lawyer too. And in addition, everything Secretary of Energy Moniz said about the JCPOA is correct. And so there is no reason for Trump to repudiate this. And indeed, in their papers here, Iran has pointed out that the sanctions were imposed now after Trump repudiated the JCPOA. So, they might get into that as well. I really can't say. All I have is the press release today on the lawsuit that came from the International Court of Justice outlining the causes of action here.
Mm-hmm. We're going to have to leave it there. We're out of time. We were joined from Urbana, Illinois by Professor Francis Boyle. He's a professor of international law at the University of Illinois College of Law and author of the book Destroying World Order, U.S. Imperialism in the Middle East, Before and After September 11th. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Elon Musk jumped into a scandal of his own making last week when he called a British cave diver who was instrumental in the rescue of a dozen Thai Boy Scouts from a flooded cave a pedophile. When called to task over the comment, he doubled down and repeated it. Now shares of his company, the automaker Tesla, have fallen 16%, and attorneys believe the aggrieved cave diver has a strong defamation case against the billionaire. We're joined from Washington by Sam Pizzagatti. He's a veteran journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he specializes in economic inequality issues. He's also the author of the new book, The Case for a Maximum Wage. Sam, it's good to have you.
Thank you.
Sam, this really is so much more than a billionaire making a fool of himself. This is an economic issue. You know, we've got Elon Musk, who's one of the wealthiest men in America, if not the world. He's constantly trying to insert himself in situations like the one we saw in Thailand last week. And then he steps on his own feet and gets himself in trouble. Well, there's an economic cost to all this. And the cost has been so severe that just over the last couple of days, the value, the overall market share value of Tesla has dropped below that of General Motors. This has cost Elon Musk billions of dollars. But more importantly, this trickles down and it hurts Tesla's workers, does it not?
Oh, absolutely. But all sorts of things help hurt Tesla's workers. The company's blindness to the unsafe working conditions at Tesla hurt Tesla workers. The inadequate pay for the auto workers there compared to other unionized auto companies hurts Tesla's workers. So he's been hurting workers at Tesla for quite some time.
Let's talk about Tesla. You know, just I want to be transparent here. I was approached by a Tesla recruiter about 2 years ago, and they offered me a job doing cybersecurity for the company. I went out to Los Angeles to interview for it, and when they finally made an offer, it was so offensively low that I actually chuckled when I thought it was a joke, and I immediately withdrew myself from consideration. But that's not unique to me. That's not special to John Kiriakou. This is something that we see all the time with Tesla workers. And we see reporting of this in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the LA Times. When Tesla workers complain because they're not unionized, they're frequently fired. We know that working conditions are terrible. Tesla headquarters is actually in a terrible part of town. It's quite dangerous. There are a whole bunch of different problems around this company, but all the while, Elon Musk is making billions of dollars.
Yes, and I think it's really important to put Elon Musk in context. That's very important not to just see him as an eccentric character, but see him as a prototype of a larger social phenomenon. And I think the first thing we got to do is accept the notion that yes, Elon Musk is a smart and creative guy, but there are lots and lots of smart and creative people in the world, and only a few of them happen to be billionaires. So how do you become a billionaire if you're smart and creative? Well, you have to be lucky, or you have to be ruthless, or you have to have a lot of help from lots of other people, or some combination of all three of those factors. And that's hard. That's hard for billionaires to accept that reality. So they create this counter narrative that says that I'm not just smart, I'm not just creative, I'm the smartest, I'm the most creative. And anybody who doesn't recognize that is just despicable, vile person. And even what we saw with Musk this past few days, somebody who doesn't accept this is a pedophile, you know, the vilest of vile people. So I think that when we have the severe concentration of income and wealth that we have in the United States and frankly, around the world, that encourages the sorts of behaviors that we see from somebody like Elon Musk.
Well, there's something sociopathic about it, isn't there? We talk about people like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos on this program all the time. We've talked about Larry Ellison, another major CEO who little by little is trying to buy the entire Hawaiian island of Kauai and push people out. It seems like there's this attitude, and this may not be unique to this period. Maybe we saw this during the robber baron age as well, but there seems to be this attitude among the super rich that they can do literally anything they want and it doesn't matter who gets hurt in the process.
Well, you know, that's right. The arrogance that we see from the super rich is boundless. I mean, we see that in Donald Trump. We see that Elon Musk and Larry Ellison, and you know, you can go down the list. And I would argue that that's inevitable. That when we allow incredible amounts of wealth and income to concentrate in the pockets of a few people, that's going to really screw up those few people. That's going to screw up how they see the world. And who suffers from that? Well, the rest of us suffer from that in all sorts of different ways.
We've got a little less than 4 minutes left. I want to ask you about your new book, The Case for a Maximum Wage. There's a national debate, of course, here in the United States about a $15 minimum wage, and a handful of states have enacted that $15 minimum wage. Most states have not. But you're talking about a maximum wage. Can you tell us a little bit about your book?
Yes. You know, I think we all understand the concept of a minimum wage. You know, societies without an adequate minimum wage, a floor under earnings, those societies invite exploitation and meanness. Well, societies without an adequate maximum wage, a ceiling on earnings, they invite exploitation and meanness, too. So in corporate America today, we have CEOs routinely making more in a morning than their workers can make an entire year. And in fact, last year, we had 20 CEOs who took home more than 1,000 times what their median, most typical workers took home. You know, so think about that. Workers in those companies would have to work over a millennium to make what their CEOs can make in just 1 year. So when you have outrageous rewards like that, they give corporate executives an incentive to behave outrageously. Those CEOs, to hit the CEO pay jackpot, they'll do whatever it takes. You know, they'll outsource, they'll downsize, they'll cheat consumers, they'll do things that sorts of things that Elon Musk does, that Larry Ellison does, and they'll leave the rest of us worse off. So we need to end that. We need to put a cap on how much income any one individual can grab.
And how would that cap be determined and implemented?
Well, actually, a president of the United States called for a cap. In 1942, Franklin Roosevelt called for a 100% top tax on income and the top tax bracket. He said no individual should have more than $25,000 after paying their federal taxes. $25,000 back then in 1942 would equal almost $400,000 today. Roosevelt didn't get his 100% top tax rate, but we did get a 94% tax rate during World War II, and that tax rate hovered over 90% for the next 20 years. And those next 20 years were the golden age for the American middle class. They saw the emergence of the first mass middle class society in the world, and we've come a long way down since then.
We have about a minute left. I want to ask you quickly about congressional support for some of these economic reform ideas. Do you see much in the way of congressional support, specifically among the Democrats?
Well, among the members of the Progressive Caucus, there's some very interesting stirrings. Keith Ellison, the congressman from Minnesota, this past March at the Progressive Caucus annual retreat, called for a maximum wage. And a number of progressive congresspeople are talking about the idea of leveraging the public purse against inequality. So if a CEO makes more than 50 or 100 times what that CEO's workers are making, that company would be ineligible for tax breaks, for tax subsidies, even for government contracts. And I think that idea has all sorts of wonderful potential.
Well, that was perfect. We were joined from Washington by Sam Pizzagatti. He's a veteran journalist and an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, where he specializes in economic inequality issues. He's also the author of the new book, The Case for a Maximum Wage. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can also hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes and at iHeartRadio. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.